Well, good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, or your family structure. And we also welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or inabilities. A little later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're either presented by a Prairie member, as is true today, or a member of the wider community, and when we get a minister again, that will be an option as well. We're now recruiting for a minister. Today, Pat Watkins, a member of our community, will be presenting the story of a black family. I have a few announcements to read before we start our service this morning. We still need more adult mystery friends, participants. If you would like to take part in this activity, please see Rebecca. She's in the back there holding her hand up. Our director of religious education, she can also give you more information. And I noticed there's a sign-up sheet just outside the main room here. Second announcement is this. On the greeting table is the latest newsletter, Journey of Hope, about building schools in Afghanistan in the remote villages. And we've been supporting this through Pennies for Peace. So you're welcome to borrow. You can, of course, contribute for the pennies. And you can also take a look at that newsletter and borrow it. Our opening words will be provided by Orange Shriver.
What greater thing is there for human souls than to feel that they are joined for life, to be with each other in silent, unspeakable memories? George Eliot.
Marsha Johnson will do our chalice lighting reading.
Our most basic instinct is not for survival, but for family. Most of us would give our own life for the survival of a family member, yet we lead our daily life too often as if we take our family for granted. Pearl Marshall.
Well, I'd like to introduce Pat. Those of us who come to Prairie often know quite a bit about Pat, but we might not know everything. I know that she grew up in New Jersey, and that's part of her bio here. I didn't know that she had attended Seton Hall University. Then she taught English. I'm an old English teacher myself. Upon losing her husband to leukemia in 1959, she and her seven-year-old daughter, Leslie, who I happen to know, moved to Frankfurt, Germany, where she worked as a registrar for the United States Armed Forces Institute, USAFI, which was headquartered in Madison and to which she transferred in 1969. When USAFI closed, she attended graduate school, then worked as an assistant director of admissions at UW-Madison, and she retired from that in 1996. She now spends her time volunteering for various local organizations and is a film and theater aficionada, in addition to bridge and two book clubs. And I lived with Pat for about a month when I was trying to get back into my house, and we had a good time. She would come back from all her events, and we would just sit and visit, or she would stand at the counter, and I guess I would stand around or sit, and we'd visit for about a half hour. So I know Pat well and enjoy her company. So Pat is going to be talking about the story of a black family. I've heard this once before, and I really look forward to hearing it again. Will you be up here?
I have to warn you that the first two photos have not been coming out very well on the last couple of presentations I've done, and it really needs to be darker than I think it is now for this to show up, so I apologize for that. I guess it would help if I turn this on. And what you see up there now is a map of the Northwest Territory, which is where this story takes place in various spots in Michigan and Ohio. We've always been conditioned to dwell on the differences between ethnic, religious, and racial groups and other segments of the population, but I hope that this presentation will show some of the similarities amongst people and realize that this, although this is the story of a black family, it's also the story of the average, typical American family going back for a couple of generations. I don't know very much about my father's side of the family, but I was blessed on my mother's side of the family with grandparents who kept records of everything and everybody, and a family which felt that frequent trips to the photographers of the day were neither a waste of time nor a waste of money. So therefore this is going to be my mother's side of the family that I'll be talking about. And in order to avoid any confusion in case that's possible, what I'm going to do is first talk about my maternal grandmother's side of the family, and then we'll have a short intermission with some music, and then I will go back and talk about my maternal grandfather's side of the family. So we begin this with, this is the a blank screen, which is supposed to be my great-great-grandmother, Rosetta. It's really too bad that this is not visible. I really apologize for this, yes. This is Rosetta McLaren, born in Gallipolis, Ohio in 1837. And her background is mysterious because much of what we know about her is founded on a few facts, bolstered by conjecture, propped up by historical and geographical information. For instance, this is what her obituary in a Saginaw, Michigan newspaper said about her in 1920.
Mrs. Rosetta McLaren, 83 years old, died Monday at the home of her nephew C.L. Johnson, 138 South 11th Street. She was a descendant of a Blackfoot Indian tribe and was born near Washington Courthouse, Ohio, January 29th, 1837. She came to Michigan at the age of 17. Her husband, Reverend Joseph McLaren, died a number of years ago. She leaves two children, Mrs. Aurora Goings of Saginaw and George Willard McLaren of Chicago.
Part of the mystery of her background has to do with how a Blackfoot Indian, a Plains Indian from the Montana area, came to be born in what was Shawnee territory. Washington Courthouse in that area, if in fact that's where she was born, was originally named Shawneetown, and northeastern Ohio was the domain of the Ojibwe, the Potawatomi, and the Shawnee Indians. She was not a full-blooded Indian, for my grandmother's notes say that either her father or her grandfather was a Frenchman from Gallipolis, Ohio, by the name of Dejanet. In the early 1800s, Gallipolis, which lay on the Ohio River, was a French village inhabited primarily by French fur traders, and it's historical fact that many of the voyageurs and fur trappers cohabited with women or married Indian women. And this is quite possibly true in the case of Rosetta because her three children were extremely fair in color, whereas she is quite dark. And although you can't see this picture, we'll see a picture of her later on, just a year before her death. It's too bad you can't see her as a young girl. Anyhow, she was quite dark, and her husband was also a brown-skinned man. She may also have been mixed with black blood, because Gallipolis, in addition to being an embarkation point for the French fur traders, was also, like 23 other river towns along the Ohio River, a point of entry for escaping slaves. And it had a history of numerous free blacks in the vicinity. And we do know for a fact that her sister Elizabeth was married to a black man who was the father of the C.L. Johnson mentioned in her obituary. And the family has always considered itself to be black. At any rate, one of the things I always found staggering whenever I look at this picture is the immense cultural leap that occurred in so short a time. Regardless of her origins, her mother, at least, was born to the lodge and the teepee, the deerskin and fur, and not speaking the English language. And yet, within a period of 30 to 40 years, she watches her daughter having a photograph taken, dressed in the latest European fashion, with her hair in long curls, and speaking a new language. This picture is an amber type, which is a photographic process which was replaced the daguerreotype. And then, without seeing the picture, there's no point in my telling you this part about the, I had this picture dated by the State Historical Society, and one of the ways that they determine the date is by the way the person is dressed, the way that she's wearing her hair, and we have figured that that this picture was taken when she was somewhere between 1854 and 1857, and we think that it might possibly have been her wedding picture. This one comes out a little better. This is Rosetta's husband, Reverend Joseph McLaren, who was born in 1807. And if we have unanswered questions about Rosetta, we have even more and more interesting ones about him. The U.S. Census from 1850 shows that there was a Joseph McLaren and his brother Edward living in Holmes County, Washington Township, Ohio, in the northeast part of the state. And although he looks to be more Indian than Rosetta does, the 1850 census says that he was born in China. Tis a puzzlement, as the King of Siam would have said. After that census, there's very little mention of him and none at all of the brother. You'll notice in the photo, also an amber type, that he's wearing a clerical collar in one of the pictures. And in one of the pictures, he's holding either a Bible or a prayer book in his hands. According to my grandmother's records, he spoke several languages and had been educated as an Episcopalian priest. One of the things that had come down in our family, but which disappeared upon my grandmother's death in 1948, was an Episcopalian Book of Common Prayer, which was inscribed with his name on the fly leaf and dated 1859. It was printed in both English and phonetic, and in a phonetic Indian language, English on the odd pages, the even pages, and then the phonetic Indian language on the odd pages. The big question for me is where and how he received his education. There were very few Episcopalian missions or seminaries in the Midwest at that time, although there was one at Kenyon College in 1838, and there were also places to educate priests in Worthington, Ohio, in Mackinac, and near Saginaw, Michigan. And I remember reading at one time, sometime back, that 8 Indians had been trained for the Episcopalian ministry, but I failed to make note of the source of that information, and I was unable to find it again one of these days. I don't know if Rosetta and Joseph met in Ohio or whether they met after Rosetta had moved to Michigan. She had moved to Michigan at the age of 17. However, after their marriage, they lived in Marshall, Michigan, where at least one of their three children were born. Joseph was 50 years old when he married Rosetta at 20, and it is possible that this may also, one of these may also have been his wedding picture. He died not many years after that in Van Wert, Ohio, which is near the border of Indiana. And we don't know whether Rosetta was living with him in Van Wert or not, because after his death, the records indicate that she was again living in Michigan, this time in Flint. I don't have the date of his death, so I'm not sure when he died. This is the oldest. Oh boy, it's not just those two pictures that aren't. Well, this was the oldest of Rosetta and Joseph's three children. Samantha, born in 1858. This photo was taken in 1874, around the time of her marriage at the age of 16, to a man by the name of Albert Reed. They had three children, and Samantha died at the age of 19. I found no record of what happened to her children, but after her death, her husband Albert Reed moved westward and was not heard from anymore. Their second child was a son, George McLaren, born in 1865. And this photo was taken between 1879 and 1881, when he was 14 to 16 years of age. This is George McLaren again as an adult. From 1890. In midlife, he moved to Chicago and married a woman who was 17 years older than he. And they had one child who unfortunately died at the age of 9. Upon his wife's death, he never remarried and he lived into his 70s. And upon his death, the McLaren name disappeared from the family history. Now, there may still be McLarens remaining from George McLaren's uncle Edward, about whom we could find no trace. I'm terribly disappointed in your ability to see these photos. At one time when we did this, it seems to me we used to have red velvet curtains at some of the windows. And you could black the room out more, but without that, it's very hard to see these. So this photo taken around 1882 shows the third of the McLaren children, and Aurora on the far left is with her first cousin Florence, the daughter of Rosetta's sister, Elizabeth Johnson. Florence later moved to Chicago, and we don't know what happened to her. And Aurora was to become my great-grandmother. In 1881, at the age of 16, she married a man by the name of James Mays and moved with him from Saginaw, Michigan, where the family was then living, to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. He was a seaman who worked on one of the Great Lakes ships, sailing, we think, from Sheboygan around the Straits of Mackinac to Bay. So he was a seaman who worked on one of the Great Lakes ships, sailing, we think, from Sheboygan around the Straits of Mackinac to Bay City, Michigan. Aaron?
Deep sea sailors might feel a pardonable scorn for the fresh water of the Great Lakes, but there is no record of any complaint that the winds and weather over the lakes were not sufficiently boisterous and capricious to hold their interest or task their seamanship.
The routine was well set in tradition. The holes were filled and the hatches battened down at the wharves. The efficient bustle of getting underway began. Then from the quarterdeck by the wheel came the shouted order, "All hands make sail!" On the lake ships, that would mean a couple of mates and a dozen sailors or so. Then the sails are trimmed to the Lake Erie wind, and the ship, spreading out over a half acre or more of canvas, crowds her way up toward Detroit, Saginaw, Mackinac, Chicago, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and Manitowoc.
Generally, the hands sang as they worked the ropes and halyards. Singing while you work was one of the traditions on the lakes. There was no time for singing, however, when the cold frontal storms broke over the lakes or a squall struck at the taut canvas with devastating fury. The shipping losses on the Great Lakes have always been stupendous. The weather is full of vagaries, the storms are fierce and tremendous, and there is no room on the narrow lakes for a ship in distress to run before them as they can upon the ocean. In the two decades between 1878 and 1898, 5,999 vessels were wrecked on these lakes. 1,093 of them were total losses of both ships and cargo, and an appalling number of men.
My great-grandfather, James Mays, Aurora's husband, was one of those seamen who lost their lives in one of the Great Lakes shipping disasters. And he drowned in Lake Michigan at the age of 28. Aurora then once again packed her belongings and with her infant daughter, Jessica Goldie Mays, who had been born in Sheboygan, made another lake voyage and came home to Saginaw. When she arrived back in Saginaw, Aurora secured work as the housekeeper, or the help, for a medical doctor by the name of Dr. Pick in that city, and she remained in his employ for many years. When Jessica grew to be school age, she and Jessica later to be my grandmother, Dr. Pick arranged for her to attend a Catholic boarding school in Bay City and paid for her education. My mother still remembered the Pick family, for whom my great-grandmother was still working when my mother was a pre-teenager. Aurora's daughter, Jessica Mays, grew up in Saginaw, and in 1902, she married Howard Clark, and in 1904, they had their only child, who was to be my mother, Doris Irene Clark. This is my mother at 4 months of age in 1904. Note the elaborate Victorian furniture of the day and what appear to be slightly Asian or Indian features. At any rate, we are going to stop for a minute, and before we take a look at my maternal grandfather's side of the family. And we have a piece of music song here from Lynn.
No more auction block for me. No more, no more. No more auction block. Many thousand gone. No more pet of corn for me. No more, no more. No more pet of corn for me. Many thousand gone.
The tiny village of Macosta lies in west central Michigan in the heart of the cutover stump country. Herschel Cross, a historically minded member of a pioneer Negro clan, proved most helpful, guiding me to his older kinfolk and other octogenarians in the area, setting them at ease, then sitting back to savor the gossipy folk history which they poured forth. Uncle Amos Cross responded to my questions immediately. The patriarch of a fruitful tribe, born in Remus in 1870, the year after his folks moved north from Ohio, Uncle Amos spoke proudly of his slave father, who grew up in Loudoun County, Virginia, and planted a noble tribe in this Michigan stump country. Taking down a 61-year-old photograph, Uncle Amos showed me a picture of himself as a young man, surrounded by his parents and 17 brothers and sisters. Of them all, only he still lived. Straight and tall, hollow-cheeked and deep-voiced with age, Uncle Amos rumbled genially about runaway slaves and the white women who had followed them north.
When 77-year-old George Norman, swarthy and mustachioed, sat on a hay bundle in the middle of a field his uncle had homesteaded and told us his grandfather had wedded a white woman from Virginia with hair as red as fire, Herschel slapped his thigh and whistled in amazement. So that's where all those red-headed Normans come from. A bizarre genealogy unfolded from one after another old settler as we poked into their past. The light-skinned spoke of German and Scottish and Polish ancestors, the dark of slave and Indian forebears. European and African, free and bond, white and black, had mingled dramatically in these families.
Well, you can imagine my surprise when I first read that passage in a book entitled American Negro Folk Tales by Richard Dorson, who was a professor of folklore at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. The Normans you just heard reference to, as well as the Crosses, were a part of my family, people whom I had met and known, and the last thing I ever expected was to pick up a book and read about them. The original Normans who entered Ohio from Virginia, which is now what is now the state of West Virginia, was Henry Norman, who escaped from slavery with Catherine, the daughter of his owner, or perhaps Catherine herself owned him. They were married when they got to Ohio, settling somewhere around the city of Zanesville, and proceeded to raise a family consisting of 6 daughters and a son, all of whom indeed did inherit the flaming red hair. And here, this is a picture of one of the Norman girls, Betsy Norman Lett, L-E-T-T, pictured with 2 of her 4 children, Grace and Sina. This slide is made from an old tintype and dates from about 1880. This is a picture of another of the Norman girls, Julia Norman Miller. And she is holding her son, Russell. You know, I wonder if this is funny that. Holding her son, Russell, known as Cap. This was also made from a tintype and is dated 1873. And then you have a picture of, this is another picture of the same girl, Julia Norman Miller, but taken at a later date, 1888. Here you have Ellen Norman, who is a third of the six girls. She's the mother of one of the few Norman cousins whom I knew personally. Her daughter, Jessie, lived just a block from my grandmother's house in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And those of you who were on that Grand Rapids trip remember my telling the story about our not being allowed to, not being able to talk to Jessie when she came home from work in the afternoons because she had a job in the local downtown Woolworth as a dishwasher. But she was passing for white and she would have lost her job if anyone had thought that she was not white. So when we got on the bus together, we couldn't speak to her until after we got off the bus, even though it was the same bus stop we got off at. Anyhow, this photo was taken about 1878 and is also from a tintype. I don't have photos of the son, George Norman, nor of the other two girls, Dilly and Fran, but here's a photo of Angeline. We're upside down. That's nice. This is not Angeline, incidentally. Let me see if I can turn this.
By the way, we will get the slides from her and scan them and make her a web page.
Since I can't see this. There's Angeline. Okay. This, sorry again. Angeline, who was my great grandmother, as she was called, married in 1880. She married William Elwood Clark in Renville, Ohio. And this is William Elwood Clark, pictured here in 1883. William Elwood Clark, who's pictured here, and his brother Lewis had been born in Bowling Green, Virginia in approximately 1850. Now, this next picture, I'm not sure whether this is William Clark or whether it's his brother Lewis Clark, but at any rate, whether they were born slave or free, we don't know, but we tend to think that they were born in slavery because a cousin of mine, who was a daughter of Lewis Clark's, remembers her father telling her as a child about his memories of the end of the Civil War and of the great rejoicing and the singing and dancing and feasting that took place when the news was announced that the slaves had been set free. The parents of these two boys had died when they were very young, and they had been raised by a neighbor woman. However, when the Civil War ended, she was no longer able to take care of them, and there was no living to be made in and around Bowling Green. So when the oldest, William Clark, was 16 years old, and Lewis just a year and a half younger, they both enlisted in the Army. And they were sent to the Southwest, where they both served for almost 20 to 25 years.
At the end of the Civil War, General Grant had said, "Let us have peace." And between the North and the South, there was peace. But with the Indian, there could be none. The old war, begun so long ago when the white man had set foot on the shores of America, never had ceased, never had been finished.
So the bugles called again and the drums rolled. Colors and guidons uncased fluttered in the wind. Once more sounded the tread of infantry and clatter of cavalry as the U.S. Army marched back to war. This army covered a lifespan from roughly 1865 to 1890, and its home was in the West. Its adversaries were the Plains Indians, the finest light horsemen the world has ever seen. and the fierce, elusive tribes of the Southwest, the Kiowas, the Comanches, and the Apaches, who swept back and forth across the Mexican border to harass Americans and Mexicans with fine impartiality.
The French Foreign Legion could not outmatch this army in its variety of nationalities. It became one of the busiest sections of the American melting pot. Negroes, many of them fresh from slavery, served in this cosmopolitan army under white officers. Fine horsemen, hard fighters, well-disciplined, they formed such splendid regiments as the 10th Cavalry. From their woolly hair and the shaggy hide coats they wore on winter campaigns, they were christened the Buffalo Soldiers by the Indians, who said it was bad medicine to scalp them.
This is Lewis Clark at about age 40. He had married a Mexican woman while he was on border duty. And upon his discharge from the army, he returned with her to Renville, Ohio, where his brother William, who'd been discharged earlier, was already living. There must have been something about these two men, maybe being in the army, that made them marriage-minded. Because when they returned from the Southwest, they each decided to make up for lost time, and each of them had three wives, consecutively, of course. Lewis Clark's young senora didn't like too much life in Ohio. Maybe it was the cold weather. And she decided that Mexico was preferable. So at any rate, she packed up and returned to Mexico, leaving her son Sing in Ohio with his father. Lewis then married a second time, having three children from his second marriage. And the family story is that the second wife mistreated the child of the first marriage, which caused a considerable amount of friction, and Lewis took her to court and divorced her, something pretty much unheard of in those days. He didn't get bitten again until he was in his 60s, at which time he took his third wife, and he had six children by her. And it was one of those six children that he had in his 60s that I corresponded with for quite a while, and she's the one who told me the story of being told about how they reacted when the slaves had been set free. Lewis's brother William Clark, who'd been the first to get his discharge from the army, instead of returning to Virginia, decided to settle in Renville, Ohio. Renville at that time had a reputation for being a reasonably liberal city, and he may have gone there for that reason or simply because he had heard there was work available. But it was here that that William Clark met and married his first wife, Angeline Norman, who was my great-grandmother. He and Angeline had two children, Howard and Jenny Clark. And Howard would grow up to be this is Howard and Jenny, and you can see this picture not only is not very visible, but it also, it's a tintype, and it got bent somehow or other and cracked in the middle. This picture was taken about 1887, when my grandfather was about 3 to 4 years old, and his sister, Jenny Clark. When William Clark returned to Ohio from his army service, he found work in the coal mines outside of Renville. And when Howard was old enough, he followed his father into the mines. However, these mines were not especially rich in ore, but whether it was because the mines were almost worked out or whether there were other reasons, William soon left the mines and, leaving his family behind, moved to Michigan to the area around Saginaw, where he found work in a lumber mill, which was big business in Michigan.
People aboard the lake ships would sometimes have to stand by for hours, while huge rafts that filled the rivers were broken up and corralled into the booms at the sawmills that lined both shores at Saginaw and Bay City. And at night, these mills sent the sharp, damp odor of freshly cut timber over the towns, and the northwest winds blew it over the harbors and out into the lakes.
You could always tell when you were passing Bay City, even at night. The deck of the ship was enveloped by the sweet, resinous smell of the millions of feet of pine boards, sawed, stacked, and ready to go to Chicago to build houses for the very people who were sailing by.
In Saginaw and Bay City, 112 sawmills lined the river, and there were 98 millionaire lumber barons in residence. 50 times a day, the bridge over the Saginaw lifted and lowered to let through the fleets of lake freighters carrying the white pine lumber to the lakeport cities and down the Erie Canal and to Albany.
After a few years, Howard also left Renville, Ohio, probably at the age of about 16 or 17, and came to Saginaw to join his father. But instead of working in a sawmill, he became a lumberjack. And again, this is another tin type, which is not showing up very well. Here you see him standing in his lumberjacking outfit with his axe by his side. This picture was taken in about 1902.
The choice logs piled up through the autumn and winter around 1,000 camps in the Great Lakes region. The piles grew bigger and bigger in the 1870s and the 1880s. By 1889, there were about 112,000 men working at the Great Lakes pineries. Throughout the slow days of the logging season, they slept like sardines in the bunkhouses, ate hurriedly in the cookhouses, saw no one but themselves, heard nothing but their own voices, the timber wolves, and the crash of falling trees.
When they got their pay, perhaps $20 or $30 per month, they rushed into town for their big spree. They rolled into Saginaw by the trainload from miles around.
And it must have been during one of those trips to town, at about the age of 20, that he met my grandmother, Jessica McLaren Mays. This is Howard at about 20 years old. I shouldn't stop to tell a story, but those of you who've been to my house may have seen this picture hanging on my wall. I had this blown up. I thought, I love this photograph. I had it blown up by Great Big Pictures, and I gave it to my mother as a gift. I thought she would like to have it. And she said, I don't want this picture. This is not the way I remember my father. He wasn't a dandy looking guy like that. And so I have it hanging over the fireplace. Anyhow, they were married in 1903, and in 1904 they had their only child, Doris Irene, whom you see here at the age of three in 1907. While they were living in Saginaw, every spring and fall, my grandmother and Howard's wife, Jessica, would travel around the Midwest as a personal maid to Sophie Tucker, who was an entertainer and singer of the day. And thus my mother was, to a great extent, raised in an extended family situation by her own grandmother, Aurora McLaren Mays, and her great-grandmother, Rosetta McLaren. And here you have a photo of those four generations of women. The lower left is my mother, she was 13 or so, on the right-hand side, stretched out, is my grandmother, Jessica McLaren Mays. To the far left is my great-grandmother, Aurora Mays, and all the way in the back is Rosetta McLaren, whose obituary we read at the very beginning. She was 83 years old at that time, and she died that was the year in which she died. And Erin?
Yep. In the 1890s, the lumber operations reached their peak, then fell back to just a trickle in the days before World War I.
And this may have accounted for the family moving, packing up and moving in 1918 from Saginaw to Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was in Grand Rapids that my mother completed high school, was married to my father, George Gaines, and gave birth to both my daughter, myself and my brother. And I guess I'm about 4 years, 3 years old at in that picture. I was 3 years old once. So anyhow, today there are Clarks and Normans all over the states of Ohio, Michigan, New Jersey, California, and other places. Some of us have disappeared over a century ago and were never heard of again. Some are with their fair skins, blue eyes, blonde and red hair, have probably crossed the color line into the white race. These people were little people. No books have been written about them. They accomplished no great feats. In earlier days, they were not even acknowledged in the census reports and simply subsumed under the names of the families they worked for or who owned them. But like other simple and little people, they contributed their share to the world we inhabit, even though that share is barely acknowledged in our history books. And they prevailed. They were good people who had courage and integrity and pride and character, and I'm very proud to be a part of them. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Our closing words will be read by Heidi.
Call it a clan, call it a network, call it a tribe, call it a family. Whatever you call it, whoever you are, you need one. Jen Howard.